You're listening to the Vermont Edition podcast. This is Meg Malone, the Vermont Edition digital producer, just here to let you know that this episode has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. In just a few months, the large field of Democratic presidential candidates will meet in their first debates. The crowd is so big, the event is going to have to be held over two nights. 4 years ago, when Senator Bernie Sanders announced his candidacy, he stood at 3% in the national polls. This year at this time, he's considered to be one of the top two frontrunners in the race. Sanders says he's putting together a national grassroots campaign with several key goals.
Which is not only going to defeat Donald Trump, who is the most dangerous president in modern American history, but with your help, we are going to transform this country and finally create an economy and a government which works for all of us, not just the 1%.
What are the chances that Sanders can win the Democratic nomination? Would he be the strongest Democrat to challenge President Trump? These are a few of the questions we have today for our roundtable of political observers. With us today, Ellen Anderson, who is a political science professor at the University of Vermont. Ted Cohn is the dean of the College of Liberal Arts at Norwich University. And Matt Dickinson, a political science professor at Middlebury College. Great to have you all here today to talk about Bernie 2020.
Thanks, Bob.
It's lovely to be here.
Great to be here with you, Bob.
And you can join our conversation by giving us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. What are your thoughts about Bernie Sanders' second bid for the White House? Do you support it? Do you feel that the message is right, but perhaps the time has come for another candidate, a younger candidate, to carry this agenda? Does Bernie represent the new face of the Democratic Party? And is he the strongest Democratic candidate to run against President Trump? Your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Well, let me start with a question for all of you. Ellen, let's start for you. As you look at Bernie Sanders 2020 compared to the race in 2016, what do you see as some of the biggest differences in this campaign?
Oh, well, there are so many. When Bernie ran against Hillary Clinton in 2016 for the Democratic nomination, he was considered a sort of a far-to-the-left long-shot candidate. And now he's considered sort of one of the leading candidates for the 2020 nomination, which puts a target on his back in a way that it hadn't been before. I think that's probably one of the biggest differences. The second biggest difference is, of course, that Bernie Sanders is running, but, you know, so are nearly two dozen other Democratic candidates for this office. And so the playing board looks really different.
Ted, what do you think?
I think one of the biggest differences is that 2016 was the year of the outsider, as we saw with the candidacy of Donald Trump. And Bernie Sanders was running against Hillary Clinton, the quintessential Washington insider. I think several years later, it's hard to see Bernie Sanders in the same way, as Ellen just said, in this crowded field where he's emerged as a front runner with backers, with volunteers, with money. Suddenly he seems a bit more establishment than he did a few years ago.
Matt, what are your thoughts?
I'd build on both those points. I would point out the benefit of 4 years in terms of putting together an infrastructure and understanding how to run a national campaign. In 2016, I think his success took him by surprise, and certainly his advisors. Coming out of New Hampshire, they didn't really know what to do. And those early hesitations, I think, hurt him. The second thing is, where's the Democratic Party today? Even compared to 4 years, I think there's a sense that the center of gravity is more contested and may have shifted left. And that puts Bernie, his candidacy, in a different light. It's more a candidacy that may be attracting the center of the party as opposed to simply being viewed as a fringe candidate.
Ellen, you mentioned that being a frontrunner means you have a target on your back. I'm wondering if we saw an example of that this week when Bernie was speaking at a town hall on CNN and he was asked if felons should be allowed to vote. He said absolutely yes, and he mentioned and pointed out that Vermont is one of two states in the country that allows felons to vote both in prison and after they get out of jail. He then was asked if this means that he would support people who could vote in prison who have committed horrific crimes. And the Boston Marathon bombing came up as an example. And he said yes, because if you start to chip away at voting rights, there's no telling where you might go. Is that an example of the target on his back?
Oh, I think that's quite right. Issues of felon disenfranchisement have become really hot-button issues among sort of Democratic activists and the sorts of folks who, you know, follow politics all the time, precisely because we disenfranchise so many people because of the time that they spend in prison. I mean, Vermont has a long and proud history of having sort of all people vote all the time. But yeah, trying to get him into a place where he seems to be defending the rights of folks who have done really horrible things is a pretty classic move, so that you can, you know, cut a campaign ad later on as you need to say Bernie Sanders supports murderers having the right to vote. You know, that sort of thing we should expect to see at some point.
You know, and Matt, it seemed that back in 2016, Bernie didn't get a lot of criticism in the campaign. Hillary Clinton didn't want to get too angry at him because she didn't want to get his supporters to oppose her. Donald Trump wanted Hillary Clinton to be wounded, so he every once in a while would say something nice about Bernie Sanders. So this is something new for the Sanders campaign, isn't it?
It is. When you're viewed as unlikely to win an election, the front runner in 2016, Hillary Clinton, has no incentive to take you on personally until she absolutely has to. But today, he is the front runner, as Ellen pointed out. And as a result, if you want to clear that lane, move him out of the lane, say you're a progressive, you're a Pete Buttigieg or a Beto O'Rourke or even, Elizabeth Warren, it's not enough to tout your own record. You have to begin taking down the record of someone else. We just saw Buttigieg yesterday saying Sanders is inelectable. And there'll be other issues that will come up as well about his lack of accomplishments in the Senate, the fact that there may be been whispering, certainly not from the candidates, but from others regarding his age. So he has to be prepared to play defense a lot more.
And Ted, one other big change, it strikes me, in 2020 is the primary schedule itself. It's really been front-loaded now. California, which used to hold its primary in June, is now going to be on March 3rd on Super Tuesday, along with Texas and Virginia and a host of other states. How does that change the dynamics of this race?
I think we're going to see a much more crowded race farther into 2020. I was struck back in 2016 how many kind of heavy hitters among the Republicans, people like Lindsey Graham and George Pataki, dropped out even before Iowa. I think that juicy, big Super Tuesday prize is going to keep some of the people in the race longer, especially if you've got favorite son candidates like Kamala Harris in California and Beto O'Rourke in Texas.
And this week, we also saw former Vice President Joe Biden entering this race. Ellen, he's listed as the other front runner along with Sanders. How do you think Biden's candidacy affects Sanders and the race in general?
Well, he's now not the only one with the target on his back. They sort of Biden and Sanders share some things in common, including their sort of relatively advanced age. And so they'll have some desire to make some sort of common cause to sort of make an argument that age shouldn't be the primary issue that people should care about here. But it's also the case that with Biden in the race, now Bernie has somebody that he can bounce his policy positions off who's also a front runner. Biden wants this, right? But with me, you would get this, right? He hasn't really been able to bounce his policy positions off of any of the other candidates, in part because doing so elevates those other candidates.
And Matt, we saw in November of 2018 a whole group of new Democrats being elected to the U.S. House, a very diverse group of people and a lot younger than many members of the House. Is age for Biden, for Sanders, is age a issue in this campaign?
I think it is for some voters. Certainly my students I've talked to have said they just have trouble identifying with these individuals. They don't really know that much about them. And I think it's going to come into play when people start considering not only the records, but the candidates who are running on those records or the issues, and they see such a disparity in age. One of the things that may save them is the incumbent president isn't exactly a spring chicken. So they can certainly point out that, you know, age hasn't been a barrier to electing a current president. But, yeah, I think this is going to come up, and how it comes up is going to be very interesting, whether it sort of is a grassroots movement or whether there's a whispering campaign by officials in some of these other candidates' campaigns. But it's certainly lurking in the background.
And, Ted, as we've mentioned, Bernie's progressive agenda in 2016 is almost mainstream in 2020. So you've got a bunch of people in this race who share his agenda?
Well, I think this is part of the narrative that came out of 2016, that this is what was fueling his success, was his progressive agenda, that he then is the grandfather of these new progressive people among the Democrats in Congress, and that he somehow in a permanent way pulled the entire Democratic Party to the left. I'm just not so sure of that. I wonder how much of 2018 was about a reaction to Donald Trump the same way the Tea Party was a reaction to Barack Obama. And I think that's something that at the end of the day is going to unite Democrats in 2020, that energy to get out the vote and get to the polls that really, I think, drove a lot of Democrats to vote in 2018.
Today in the program, we're looking at Bernie Sanders' second bid for the White House. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. If you have some thoughts, do you support Bernie's effort? Do you think maybe it's time for a younger Democrat to carry the same progressive agenda? Do you think he's the best Democrat to run against President Trump? Love to hear your thoughts on this subject at 1-800-639-2211. So let's start with Chris in Randolph. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Yeah, I have a few, a couple of concerns with regard to follow through with what he's doing. First of all, when he proposes Medicare for all and or free college, I don't see a lot of specifics with regard to follow-through of how it's going to be taken care of. And then the second issue is with regard to free college for all. I'm surprised that he's not more focused on high school education and preparing our children for college better in the first place. Could you speak to those issues, please?
Ted, what about that?
Well, I think Chris, you know, raises a good point, and it really builds on what I was trying to say about progressivism inside the Democratic Party. When you ask Democrats about the support for Medicare for All, they support it. And then when you start asking follow-up questions like, well, are you willing to see your taxes go up? Are you willing to give up your private insurance for this? Then suddenly support starts going down. And so I think this is a real challenge to a number of the progressives in the race that I'm not sure how deeply rooted current progressivism is inside the Democratic Party. In terms of high school education, you know, what is the federal government's role in local education? I think that's always been one of the big questions when, of course, local education is funded by property taxes.
And Ellen, how important do you think it is that candidates like Bernie Sanders and other progressives in the race identify funding sources for some of their plans that people want to know how they're going to be paid for?
Well, at some point, That's going to be important. I'm not entirely certain it's important right now. We see in some ways some different styles emerging from the various candidates who are running. There's sort of the Elizabeth Warren model, which is to come out with some fairly, you know, fleshed out policy proposals, you know, every day or two, which do a lot in terms of identifying funding mechanisms and being sort of really clear about how she, what her vision is about how you practically accomplish her plans. You see the sort of Pete Buttigieg model, which is sort of what we need is broad scope narrative. We need to have we need to sort of take back narratives about the Democratic Party as being the, you know, party for the, you know, the working class, party for people who aren't rich, party for, you know, party for folks who are, you know, African-American or who are LGBTQ, right, before getting into specific policies, right? And then Bernie's sort of threading the space in the middle, right, where he has these sort of general concepts of where he wants to go, but he's not going to get drawn into the weeds on it right now. And I don't think he's going to get himself drawn into the weeds until he absolutely has to. At least if that's how we were looking at what he did in 2016, if he's playing about that same playbook, he's going to escape. He's going to sort of he's going to come up with a couple, three real clear big ideas. And he's going to try not to be in the weeds for as long as he can.
Matt, it really brings up an interesting point that Ellen did. And there was an article this week in the National Press about New Jersey Senator Cory Booker and his whole temperament of his campaign, which is let's build some consensus in this country. Let's get back to working together. It doesn't have to be a, you know, a situation where we yell and scream at each other all the time. And he's finding out that as he travels around Iowa, that's not the message that people want to support at this time.
Well, there's two things to keep in mind here, and I think Ted and Ellen both made some important comments about this. One is the future of the Democratic Party partly is up for grabs. We don't know what Democrats stand for because we don't know which message is going to resonate with them, and candidates are floating different messages out there. When we think – I think Ted's absolutely right. The 2018 midterms, most of the Democratic gains were in purple states. Many of the women elected were not AOC, who's gotten most of the publicity here, but actually they were running relatively moderate campaigns saying, I'm going to protect your health care benefits that you already have. They didn't necessarily say they were running on Medicare for all. So that's an important thing to keep in mind here. This is a very fluid race. Different candidates. The reason we have 21 candidates is because it seems wide open in terms of what the Democratic Party stands for. And if you look at the fundraising totals that have come in, you can see different candidates' messages resonating with different groups, small donors flocking to O'Rourke and Buttigieg and, of course, Sanders. But those larger donors backing Harris, who may be viewed as more of a party candidate. The other thing I would quickly point out, we haven't talked much about race here, but on many issues, the sort of progressive affluent white vote is more liberal than on social issues, for instance, for many African Americans who are more church-based. And Booker's message may resonate very well with them or a Kamala Harris in a way that, you know, Iowa, which is predominantly white, the message doesn't resonate. So the sequence of primaries, the different messages, this is really a very fascinating race.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today we're looking at Bernie Sanders' bid for the White House. With us today, Ellen Anderson, a political science professor at the University of Vermont, Matt Dickinson, a political science professor at Middlebury College, and also Ted Cohn, who's the dean of the College of Liberal Arts at Norwich University. Let's talk to Ken, who's calling from Burlington. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I think the word socialism is what's going to do Bernie in. I personally support democratic socialism, but the great unwashed of the world, especially with help from the Republicans, are painting socialism as the Soviet Union communism, you know, better dead than red. And I think unless Bernie can find a way to escape that kind of scare tactics, he's never going to make it.
Okay, Ken, thanks very much for your phone call. Matt, what about that? You can almost hear President Trump using the word socialism every other word when describing Bernie Sanders.
And I think even among his Democratic rivals, if they don't necessarily come out against socialism, they are going to come out in the sense of, well, Bernie's track record of getting things done has not been particularly prominent, and is he electable? I think that's the subtext here. Without even saying the word socialism, I think some Democrats are going to say, you know, we need to be practical. 2016, it was one thing to sort of flirt with these ideas, but now we need to win back the White House, and the most important thing here is pushing issues that in the general election are going to attract voters. And one of the questions we have here is Bernie demonstrating that he can go beyond that 25%, those core voters that fueled his campaign in 2016. Right now, it doesn't seem like he's expanding that coalition yet.
And Ellen, it seems like Matt's comments are really the center of this whole issue and this whole debate. And that for the Democrats is poll after poll shows that most Democrats want a candidate who can defeat Donald Trump. Policies and ideology can be a little bit flexible, but they want the strongest candidate to defeat Donald Trump. And the question is Bernie Sanders that candidate?
Right. What we have now, if I can get wonky for a second, is we have a massive coordination problem among Democrats, whether we're talking about the electorate or whether we're talking about the party itself, right? Everybody wants a candidate that's going to win in the fall. What we don't know is which candidate has the attributes that are most likely to beat Donald Trump. And so this issue of electability, man, that does a lot of work for us in terms of how we think about the ways we are comparing candidates to one another. Is he electable because he's too old? Is he electable because he's too far to the right? If we take a look at the candidates who are pretty consistently sort of in the sort of top three and four in terms of sort of name recognition, right? There's an overemphasis on sort of white men, right? We have some incredibly strong female candidates, and part of the questions that we're kind of asking is, well, can, you know, are voters willing to elect a female candidate? Are voters willing to elect a gay candidate? Are voters willing to elect a candidate who's not white, right? So this sort of this electability question is bedeviling sort of many of the candidates here.
And Ted, the whole idea, I guess conventional wisdom would say, and certainly correct me if I'm wrong, that if a liberal Democratic candidate wins the primary, they need to sort of move towards the middle to pick up that vote in order to be successful in some states and win the presidency. Other people would say, no, that's not the case. You got to just fire up the base. And if you can get those people out to vote, you know, you don't have to tack towards the middle. What about that?
Well, and this is exactly how I think Democrats have been relitigating the 2016 election and wondering, how did we get into this situation with President Donald Trump? Is it because Donald Trump was successful in peeling away white, working class, non-college educated males into the Republican Party? Or was it because young people and people of color, the Democratic base, didn't come out in key places like Milwaukee and Detroit? And so for a lot of Democrats, it's, well, which candidate is the one who's going to answer that question? Is it going to be an older person, a working class person, a white male, or is it going to be one of these younger progressive liberals, a woman, a person of color that can fire up the base? I don't think there's a clear answer to what that is. And maybe the answer is both of those things.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Owen, who is calling from White River Junction. Hi, Owen. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me. My name is Owen. I use he, him pronouns. I'd just like to say that I think that it's a mistake that Bernie Sanders is making by talking about Trump so much. I think that he is bringing the fight down to Trump's level, which is the level of name-calling and arguing on Twitter. And I think instead what Democrats need to do is focus on what policies can serve the American people and how they can bring those policies to the forefront in their presidency. And that's why I support Pete Buttigieg. I think that his messaging of talking about the values that the Democratic supports and how he plans to implement those kind of values is the kind of strategy that we need right now. And I just want to make the quick point that I think we should be taking the conversation away from attracting the disenfranchised white middle class voters. And I think we should be focusing the conversation more on enfranchising people of color, people in minorities who maybe were alienated by the last election, and just taking the conversation away from the dominant rhetoric of attracting more white male voters. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Owen, thanks very much for your phone call. Matt, I wonder if Owen's comments sort of reflect the Democrats' view on impeachment. You've got a number of people in the race, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, who are supporting the launching of impeachment in the House. Bernie Sanders is not. He said things need to be investigated, but there are some Democrats who fear that if impeachment proceedings start, then everything is going to be all about Trump and nothing's going to be about Medicare for all or free college tuition or a carbon tax.
Absolutely. I think this is the argument that Nancy Pelosi is trying to make and trying to keep her left flank in order here. Let's not jeopardize 2020 by making it all about Trump over the next 2 years. The question is whether she can control that faction any better than Paul Ryan was able to control the Freedom faction on the conservative wing. The other quick point I would make about the caller backing Pete Buttigieg is kind of interesting here, because even as we argue that the Democrats need to broaden their support behind beyond the sort of white affluent progressive vote that backed Sanders, that is actually so far where Buttigieg's center of gravity seems to lay. And he may have problems attracting the black vote, in part because of some incidents involved in his mayor term down in South Bend. So this, it's really fluid here as the condition the candidates try to position themselves, in part because we don't know what's going to be most receptive. But impeachment, I think, is a hugely problematic issue for Democrats. And that's why so few of them, beyond Warren and Harris, have come out squarely on the basis of pursuing it.
Ellen, how much is impeachment an issue, you think, for the Democrats? For Warren and Harris going right out there and saying, let's impeach Donald Trump, other candidates like Bernie saying, not so fast, we need to investigate more. Does this become sort of a pivotal factor in this race?
It certainly can be. The Democrats, in terms of the information that's sort of leaking out into the media that we all have access to, sort of have a set of decisions to make about how they're going to treat the Mueller report, right? Are they going to move from sort of investigation and then see what happens there and whether or not they should bring impeachment after that? President Trump has clearly thrown down the gauntlet by sort of stating that he's going to ignore sort of any and all subpoenas to appear in front of Congress, right? He wants to throw this into the courts, which is clearly a delaying factor. All he needs to do is keep pushing it back till after the next election, really, even if he ultimately ends up losing that. I suspect that the real problem that Democrats are facing in terms of impeachment isn't so much whether or not to impeach, but how voters are going to think about what Democrats are doing. Are voters going to treat Democrats as just being hyperpartisan if they impeach? Versus, are they going to think that Democrats were being wishy-washy and just thinking about the 2020 elections if they don't impeach?
And Ted, do you think some Democrats are looking back 20 years with the impeachment proceedings against Bill Clinton, and that didn't work out real well for the Republicans in 1998?
Yeah, impeachment's very risky for the Democrats. It's very risky for any party that actually pursues this as being seen as gumming up the gears of government, of being vindictive. And then, of course, Clinton was acquitted, which with a Republican-dominated Senate, Trump was likely to be acquitted. And so now the Democrats have just handed Donald Trump a clear victory, maybe even an October surprise that could propel Trump back into the presidency. I think Nancy Pelosi is quite right to be hesitant about this. I'm with Ellen. I'm a little more cautious about saying this is, you know, the central kind of pivot point among Democrats. But I think, you know, this is actually, Pelosi is right that this is a real risk for Democrats.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Tom, who's calling from Montreal. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. I worry that the primary process has built into its calculus basic disingenuousness, that we're not really looking to produce the candidate for the Democratic Party that is best and represents the values of the party, but represents the white people in Iowa, the people who wake up early in New Hampshire, and whoever else is third in line. That's, I believe it's South Carolina. This is not what the Democratic Party is. Because if you look at the Democratic Party, it was basically split. Those who detested Hillary and those who could stomach her, those who were emboldened by Bernie the Progressive, you know, and those who thought that Hillary was too much of a centrist. It was basically a 50-50 split. I think you can't look at whoever happens to be first past the post in a field of 20 and say, yeah, this is the voice and this is the vision of the party. Clearly, you're going to get the top, 5-10 who are going to do well. And most are going to do well because they have name recognition. And let's be honest, people like Kamala Harris, who, used to go to school across the street from me, she's only been in the Senate for 2 years. And it's very nice. She's been, living her life and working hard in another time zone. But, other than the fact that she's a black woman, that's about it, all she brings to the table. The same with Cory Booker. Cory Booker's a centrist. And, by virtue of the fact that he was born a black man, that's what he's bringing to the table. Pete Buttigieg is another centrist. He has not come up with policies. Every single candidate has flaws, drawbacks, and, lack of experience or has done missteps. And right. You can't just say that the primary is going to automatically produce the best candidate.
And Tom, I do think that Cory Booker's supporters would say, he was the mayor of Newark. And Kamala Harris supporters would say she was attorney general in California, so that both of those candidates have some experience outside of their experience in the U.S. Senate. But Matt, what about the idea? I mean, let's look at the first four states, Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, Nevada. What does that tell us about the Democratic Party?
Well, it tells us one thing. They're aware of the issue the caller just raised, which is they have a very racially diverse electorate that they need to appeal to. And, in fact, the reason these four states are leading the nomination process is in order to sort of test very early the capability of the nominees, the potential nominees, to attract a diverse coalition. And remember, the Democratic Party's goal here is really twofold. One is to attract or nominate a candidate who is closest to the center of gravity of the party, but still able to get elected. Now, we're in a period now where some winnowing is going to take place. As you noted at the outset of the election, of today's program, there's two debates coming up in June and July in Miami and Detroit. There'll be some winnowing in candidates coming out based on that debate performance. We'll have a smaller field when the voting actually begins. But history suggests that after that initial of voting. There'll be another winnowing process that goes on, and you'll probably only have 2 to 3 candidates who hang in there, who are viewed as viable. You may have some other candidates hanging on as well. But we'll have answers to these questions by coming out of South Carolina and Nevada on which messages are resonating with which voting coalitions, I think.
Well, and the fact that California and Texas are also they've moved up in the primary system, so that even folks who aren't scoring as well as they might have wished in the first 4 states, right, have some really big states that look quite different coming up afterwards. I mean, I do think that fairly early on we'll get some sense of which candidates are appealing to which sort of parts of the electorate. I suspect we'll have more than 2 or 3 hanging on, although, frankly, predictions from this far out are always a bit of a fool's game. I try to be careful not to look too foolish too often. I do think that, you know, these folks actually have a nice depth of different kinds of experience that they ought to be able to pull up and talk about, and that the fact that we have so many people running for office in the Democratic Party should do the Democrats well, just so long as they don't turn into a circular firing squad, right? But if it becomes a place to really air out their differences and their similarities and to paint them all favorably to Donald Trump, that could do a lot to mobilize Democrats to be excited about the 2020 race, and not just excited to get rid of Trump, but excited to put a particular person in.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today we're looking at Bernie Sanders' bid for the White House in 2020. With us today, Ted Cohn, who is the Dean of College of Liberal Arts at Norwich University, Ellen Anderson, a political science professor at the University of Vermont, and Matt Dickinson, who is a political science professor at Middlebury College. Your thoughts? Love to hear from you today. 1-800-639-2211. Ted, there's another change that's coming up this year, and that's how delegates are awarded. We don't have superdelegates. You were talking earlier about superdelegates. But if I remember how the Democratic primary process works, a candidate has to receive at least 15% of the vote to be awarded any delegates whatsoever. Now, if you've got 20 people in the field, there aren't going to be a lot of them that get more than 15% of the vote. How does this factor in?
And so this is actually the way that, you know, we could see, you know, a winnowing of the field very quickly, and how some people will, you know, very early on not be able to see a path to victory or a path even to Iowa or beyond Iowa. And, you know, just to circle back to what the previous caller was saying, and we've talked about before, Bob, that the polarizing effect that, you know, primaries can have on the two parties, that the people who come out to vote in primaries and the people who come out in general elections are not necessarily the same people. And the people who come out in primaries don't necessarily reflect the voters who come out in a general election. And we don't have superdelegates this year who might have been a moderating influence in the Democratic Party. I hope the Democrats aren't going back to the days of, you know, Eugene McCarthy and Michael Dukakis.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Dan, who's calling from Newfane. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks. Hey, I just wanted to point out, you know, the conventional wisdom right now is, oh, if the Democrats impeach, it's going to be really bad for them, because when the Republicans impeached Clinton, they really took a hit politically. And when they were in the middle of that impeachment, which was kind of groundless, they did take a hit politically. But when the next election cycle came around, we had a Republican president, we had a Republican Senate, and a Republican House. So they didn't really suffer politically from doing their impeachment. So I wish that people would quit acting as if impeachment is a death knell of the party that did it, because the historical facts say otherwise.
Okay, Dan, thanks for your phone call. Matt, what about that argument?
I'm going to take issue with it a little bit. Part of the reason Al Gore lost the Electoral College vote and narrowly won the popular vote in 2000 less than we expected is because, in fact, he didn't run on the issues that Clinton had run on. He didn't sort of say, I'm going to be the same as President Clinton, although my private behavior will be more impeccable. Instead, he tried to sort of move the party to the left, and most political scientists think that was the wrong strategy at the wrong time, and that allowed Bush to sneak out a narrow contested victory. If you look at polls today, most Americans, I think Ted alluded to this, are not in favor of impeachment. I think, and for the reasons Ted, I think, so eloquently pointed out, it's not the issue of concern. Once you get beyond sort of the firebrand cultural warriors and sort of the hardcore partisan small donors, most Americans are worried about pocketbook issues and security issues. And they don't want to see the two parties, which are already deeply unfavorable, engage in another knockout fight over issues that are not likely to change anybody's mind in either party.
Let's talk to Michael, who is calling from Newberry. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Thank you for having me on. I say I am a proud Vermonter, fully supporting Bernie. I would like to see Bernie, and I think it would be smart if he would address more environmental matters, particularly clean, safe water. This country and the whole world is going to be in a crisis, and none of the candidates are really discussing the environment other than global warming, which is important, but sometimes complicated to understand. Clean, safe water is something that will hit home with all voters, no matter what party they're from the polluted groundwater of southwestern Vermont to lead poisoning in some of our cities like Chicago, to the droughts in the southwest, to the residual effects of pesticides and herbicides building up in the Mississippi Delta. Clean water is going to provide good something that people can understand and hit home. It's going to provide jobs. It deals with health care. It's going to stimulate the economy. And it's so important to our future. So
all right,
like
Michael, Michael, we appreciate your phone call. We're almost out of time. Ellen, I wanted to read just very briefly from an article in the Washington Post this week, and it has to do with Bernie Sanders' appearance at a candidates' forum sponsored by She the People, a group that aims to drive up voter participation among women of color. Quote, before an audience of about 1,700, many of them African-American and Hispanic women, the moderator asked Sanders how he would handle the rise in white supremacy. Sanders spoke of fighting discrimination and running a campaign, quote, to bring our people together around an agenda that speaks to all people. And then he returned to his familiar message on universal health care. For many in the audience, that was insufficient, the article said. Come on, a woman shouted from the back as others began to jeer and boo. What do you make of that?
Bernie has never had deep support in the African-American or Latinx communities. He didn't have it in 2016. He doesn't seem to be developing it in 2020, although I think his campaign is significantly more aware of the need to gather support sort of outside the white community. It's a real weakness for him. And look, Bernie is going to run on economic issues because that's who Bernie is, right? All other issues are going to be secondary to economic issues for Bernie because he really does truly and deeply believe that if you can get the economic issues working better, everything else gets better too, right? So African-American women in particular are real mainstays of the Democratic Party. It's their turnout and their voting so heavily in favor of Democrats that has made the difference in a number of elections. The candidate who is going to really mobilize turnout among Democrats themselves is going to have to find a way to connect with African Americans and ideally with the Latinx community as well. They are traditional undervoters. So if you can get them out, that's great. But you got to get African Americans. If you're a Democrat, you got to get African Americans willing and eager to come out and vote if you're going to win.
It's been a fascinating discussion today, really our first roundtable exploring Bernie Sanders' second run for presidency. And we hope to be able to do these kinds of programs on a regular basis in the future. Many, many thanks to our guest today. Ellen Anderson from the University of Vermont, Ted Cohn from Norwich University, and Matt Dickinson from Middlebury College. I want to thank all three of you for taking the time to be with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Bob. Thank you, Bob.